This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It is November 13th, 2019. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch.
Do you really think I'm friendly?
Friendly and lovely, too, dear.
Aw. That's nice.
How about that?
Yeah.
This is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and you're listening live, you can call us right now at 860-486-9487. And the friendly and lovely Dr. Fran Storch will answer the phone. Or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. If you're listening to this on podcast, you can send an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Or you can visit and comment at Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Moving right on to the Ron's rant of the week. Okay, so here it is. Cyclists who scream at drivers of motorized vehicles. You're not getting anywhere, okay? Yeah, you're yelling out. You're letting them know that you're mad. I understand that. You've got their attention. There's other ways to get their attention, but being a road rager back at the car is not a good way to start, because you're way off base when you go that way. So if you're looking for three smart ways cyclists can handle drivers with road rage, this is a suggestion to you. Angry drivers are always scary, but far more so when you're on a bike, and here's how to get yourself out of a bad situation. And I can say that I have been in situations where I have been able to use the very first one right on the list here is diffuse the road rage situation. Okay, so what does that mean? That means you need to be calm. Okay, you need to be rational. I know you almost got hit by a 4,000-pound vehicle. They did something that they were either aware or unaware of. Chances are unaware of. That's probably where it's at. So if you look at it from this point, some motorists want to see cyclists do something wrong so they can gripe about it. That's interesting. This is from a police officer in Fort Worth, Texas, and the Law Enforcement Bicycle Association. But often cyclists are doing nothing wrong, and they're still prime targets for driver anger. A survey of 1,000 drivers in Britain by an e-bike retailer found that 39% of the respondents admitted to getting angry with a cyclist, often because of incorrect beliefs about the cyclist's rights to the road. So, it states it here, may feel good to flip the bird or yell at the driver who cut you off and or did something aggressive with the car, but it might legally make your instigator and can certainly escalate an already volatile situation. You have no idea what's going on in the driver's head, and you have no idea if they're armed, for instance. That's definitely something you want to check out on. A study of the gun violence archive data by thetrace.org, that's thetrace.org, showed that incidences of gun violence in road rage altercations more than doubled from 2014 to 2016. And in 2016, the data showed that 620 incidents where road rager brandished a gun or fired it. So don't play that game. Better yet, And I can tell you, I have some methods that work fairly well. I always take a look at the situation. If I've had a problem with the car, I may yell out to them if they did something that threatened my life. Okay, I might yell something out. It won't be profane. It won't be in any way offensive. It'll just be a loud yell so they understand that they have come too close to me, or maybe they've, they have done something they shouldn't be doing. I'm also an advocate of, and this is a tough one because this does make the driver of the vehicle get a little bit hot under the collar, but I am not against tapping the side of the car with my hand either, which will get their attention because if they're that close to you, they should know that they almost hit you. And that's a great way to do it. First thing you do, smile and wave. Smile and wave. All of a sudden, they're not looking at you like you are using your middle finger. You're smiling. You're trying to be friendly. And the moment they step out of their car, if they should step out of their car or roll down their window, thank them very much for stopping and talking with you. Very, very simple. You just turn it from a negative situation into a positive situation. And at that point, you ask a really simple question. Do you know why I hit the side of your car? Do you know why I yelled out? Whatever it may be, you might want to just ask that question. They may not know. They may not understand.
This hitting the car, the side of the car thing, I have a question about that.
Sure.
Is it legal?
Is it legal? Probably no more illegal hitting you.
There's a specific answer to that question.
I don't know.
We need to find out because you're touching a person's possession,
right,
and they don't necessarily want you touching it. There may be, like, for you to actually touch their car. I mean, you know, in an ordinary circumstance, if you're walking down the road and somebody's about to get into their car and you happen to briefly lean against it because you're getting something out of your pocket so you can,
right,
like, pay a meter. So the person's probably not going to care. But if you this is a situation that's charged,
right,
and you're technically touching somebody else's property without their permission, could they come after you for that?
Maybe.
Not only are you touching it, you're whacking it.
If they're within 3 feet of you.
Because you hit it hard enough so they can hear what they did.
Well, you can, yeah.
They can hear what you did.
It doesn't take much for them to hear it.
So that means you reached out, you hit it, and you didn't just touch it, you hit it.
Right.
You have to find out if that's legal or not.
I do. And that's a really good question. So we need to reach out on that. If anybody knows about this and can get back to us, you could reach out to us at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Or you could answer on our Facebook page, Bicycle Talk.
If it's not legal, you shouldn't be doing it.
You're right. And the thing is, you know, they are the vehicle. If I can reach out and I can hit the side of a vehicle, the vehicle is illegally too close to me.
That's true.
So there is a legality issue there, too.
Because we have a
3-foot rule here in the state of Connecticut. It is 3 feet from my shoulder, the center of my shoulder, out to the end of my fingertips. So if I can hit the car enough to make a noise, which would be with the palm of my hand, they are within 3 feet of my space.
Yes.
So they're in my space at that point.
They are
illegally.
Illegally. They are. That is true. So they're doing something illegal. But if you actually touch them, that may be illegal. That's why you can use those. You can use, you know, swimming noodles.
Yeah, those work too.
3-foot swimming noodles.
But if your swimming noodle hits their car, is that illegal?
Now that's a collision, I think, because that's not you trying to hit them. Because if you have a swimming noodle sticking out, you're not touching them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if somebody, it's technically part of your vehicle now. And so if they hit you, then they've hit you. They shouldn't be able to. Because if you have a swimming noodle, you're just going along the road, and your entire ride, your 25-mile ride, you have a swimming noodle attached to you. It's part of you. It's part of your vehicle. So if they touch that, that's probably illegal to the car.
Right, right.
Yeah. Anyway, these are questions you should dig into. Yes.
But the key point here is you want to diffuse the situation. So diffusing the situation makes a big, big difference. You're going to, and you want to disengage from road rage conflict. Don't get into a shouting match. It doesn't go anywhere. It really doesn't work. Try to kill them with kindness. That's the best thing you can do. Be as rational as possible. Even if you feel like your life was just threatened, you need to still be rational. You still need to be as nice as you can. And engage in a positive conversation if you can. Most people, my experience has been that most people who will stop and talk to you have no idea that they've done something wrong. They consider you to have done something wrong. And that is why they're stopping to talk to you about it, because they're pretty upset about the fact that you are on the road. They don't understand that you have the right to be on the road. So the best thing to do is to try to get into some sort of a rational conversation, and basically you want to disengage from conflict. So a nice conversation works great. My favorite is to have my cell phone out and either have it on a video so that it is actually recording the situation, or simply inform the driver that you are about to call the authorities and have someone come along and discuss what happened between both of us and get a neutral party involved that is of law enforcement. And if you can do that, you can usually get them to calm down and listen to you. I mean, it works most of the time. So anyway, but don't yell. That's my whole point. Don't yell at them. It doesn't work.
You need to tell that to yourself.
I know. So defend, but only defend from a driver's road rage. If the driver is physically aggressive, you can't get to a safe place. Do everything you can do to prevent violence. Call 911 right away.
Yeah.
And leave the call live, even if you can't talk to a dispatcher. Put your bicycle between yourself and the driver and never get violent against a person or their vehicle, even if you feel threatened, because legally they can make you the aggressor. So, especially if you don't have any witnesses. It's the same in a bar fight. It's your story versus the other guys. So you want to stay away from getting into an altercation, a physical altercation. But that cell phone, I'm telling you, is the absolute best weapon that we own when we're riding our bicycles. And if you don't ride with your cell phone, I don't quite understand, because it's a very, very useful tool in many ways. But that one right there is the big one. The fact that you can get help if you need help. And you can also I like this fact that they say, even if you can't get through to them, leave it live and open, because eventually someone will come on and it's being recorded right away. The first thing they say, this is 911, we're recording your call, how can I help you? They say that right away.
Yeah.
You just keep it recorded.
And you also can text 911.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, those are the three tips. The three tips are defend, but only defend from driver's road rage. And the other one is disengage from the road rage conflict. And the third one being diffuse the road rage situation. That's the first and foremost. Diffuse and try to talk rationally. So that hopefully will help someone out if they're feeling like they've had some encounters that they're a little concerned about. That covers my rant of the week. And if you have any further discussion about this, you can do it on my Facebook page, Bicycle Talk, and let us know how you feel about this. On a positive side, I went to the Bike Walk Connecticut annual dinner, which is a really cool thing, because lots of bicycle-friendly and bicycle-minded people are there. And it is also an organization that is advocating for pedestrian safety on the road, too, or on our sidewalks everywhere, basically. So I went to the annual dinner, and there were a number of people actually from our bicycle club, which was nice to see. And also some people, same people that were also, they're also from Bike Mansfield. So we had our local group was represented well at our table, which was very, very nice. And it was a big success. There is a quiz that I would like everyone to take. I went to the Bike Walk Connecticut. Basically I went to their website and was looking, and they have a test your share the road IQ, take the quiz. I missed a couple of them. You might want to take this little quiz. I've been following pedestrian and cycling safety for a long time, and I was a little off on a couple of the answers. What I said was correct, but there was more to it. So you can you might want to check that out. There's a great brochure that is available. You can download it, or you can simply just read it. You can bring it in as a PDF, and you can read through it. It's called Give Respect, get respect, share the road, Connecticut. And it's a nice little trifolded type of brochure that you can look at, and it'll give you some information. And it's a nice thing that you might want to even print a few copies of it out, and you can hand it to people that you know, sometimes you get in discussions with, or you can keep it in as a file in your smartphone. If you have a smartphone, you can do that. And you can send it over to somebody who is having a discussion with you about, you know, you cyclists, you know that discussion. So if you have somebody who's doing that, send over this piece of information, because it's great. It tells a lot. It gives a lot of information. And a lot of information, once again, I would say that at least 50% of the encounters that of people being road ragey on the road are probably because of ignorance. And once they are educated, then things change, because they realize that, you know, the laws are directed towards both of us, both vehicle owners that are out riding, out using the roads. So anyway, just a big shout out to Bike Walk Connecticut. I got a little attaboy from Susan, which is really nice, because she was on the show a few weeks ago, and she talked up about how if you want to get on the show, you should definitely contact Ron, because it's not nearly as scary as she thought it was going to be. So that was kind of fun. I got another piece that just came in on an email from my good friend Mike in Eastford, and he sent over a really cool on the positive side here. 82-year-old British cyclist completes 1 million miles. Pretty cool, huh? This is from November 8th, 2019, and the rider's name is Russ Mantle, and he's completed 1 million miles ridden on a bicycle. And he's from England. The 1 million miles on the bike is the equivalent of traveling to the moon and back twice. He rode the last 4 miles with a group of friends along a canal in the town of Mitchett, 30 miles west of London, on his way to a cafe, of course. So anyway, pretty cool. This is a big, big shout out to Russ Mantle, who has surpassed 1 million miles on his bicycle. That's just really, really amazing. And he there's a neat little article here. This was actually in from PRI, Public Radio International, and it's a great little article about this. So there's a little radio cast on this too. So he has owned 10 bikes in his lifetime. The first one was a gift from his father in 1951. Since 1952, he has logged miles on as a competitive cyclist, a member of local cycling clubs, and also while touring on his bike in Europe, the U.S., and Canada. And his quote here is, "I usually keep one bike only for all my tours. So there's one of my bikes that has done all the highest passes in Europe, Canada, and America, Ireland, and the British Isles, Spain, Italy, France, Austria, Germany, Norway, Corsica, and Sardinia." That's pretty cool. So this guy has been all over the place. He was a competitive cyclist back in 1961. He did a 25-mile time trial in Crawley in the UK, and he came in first with a time of 58:12 for 25 miles. A man can move a bike. Pretty cool. And so after his million-mile accomplishment, Mantle, a public works retiree, has done the math and thinks it's possible to log on another million by age 100. I love it. His mileage is still decreasing each year, so he might do between 5 and 6,000 average for the rest of his life, and that would be another million. Amazing. That is amazing. So anyway, great. Shout out to Mike from Eastford for sharing that with us. That's just such a cool thing. I thought that since we're talking about a few milestones here, I do have another one in here, which we will get to in a bit. And I'll talk a little bit about Beryl Burton, because she has a book out. So anyway, the maintenance minute. Can riding a carbon frame on your trainer harm your bike?
Well, if it can, I just did it today, so I'm in trouble.
So it's trainer season, right? So why is it trainer season, Fran? How warm was it at our house this morning?
I think, was it in the teens when you got up?
It was 16.
16,
there were
16
of them, yes.
I was going to go with you.
I heard there were some areas that had single digits this morning.
I was going to go with you to spin class, and then I didn't.
It was 75 degrees in spin class.
Ah,
it was
very nice.
Yeah, it's very, very nice.
But it required getting up. I just couldn't do it.
And there were a dozen people there that were doing that this morning. So we had a nice little crowd, and I you know, kicked their butts because, you know, that's what I do.
I'll come next week.
And, you know, we did a good high burst interval workout here today. So we did a good job. So anyway, this little piece I got actually out of Velo News and by the guru Leonard Zinn. And Leonard Zinn had this question put across to him. As winter approaches, lots of us are getting ready for smart trainer season. In the past winters, this person has paired his Serrata Atrot with his Wahoo Kicker. However, he also has a full carbon frame, a Colnago C60, and he's curious about how advisable it is to mount carbon frames onto fixed bindings of trainers. He says, I've heard that it can void the warranty, but I see many videos of people riding carbon frames on trainers. Is this a case where carbon frames actually won't handle the specific stresses related to being mounted on a trainer, or are the manufacturers just being overly cautious? Does carbon frame compatibility vary by manufacturer? So,
I never thought about that.
Yeah. So Leonard reached out and he talked to, he said he got some responses from carbon frame manufacturers to the question. And Specialized Bicycle said there's certainly something to this concern. The loads on the bike frame are totally different in the rear triangle on a trainer compared to the ride on the road. The finite element analysis, a predictive computer modeling method of how a structure will react to applied forces, would say that the constraints are different. We have a special lab to test double check for this situation, since that test is not an adequate predictor of trainer frame fatigue. The popularity of Zwift over the last few years has certainly driven many of our riders to train indoors. I would recommend that a trainer user verify with the manufacturer of their bike by way of the owner's manual and the web by their particular bike to see that their particular bike is suited to sustain indoor training usage. A final note, since users are generally swapping out the rear wheel to put the bike on the trainer, there is a potential for problems and abuse of the bike. The rider should regularly inspect the bike and make sure the trainer isn't damaging the bike. So that was from Mark Schroeder, who is an engineering director at Specialized Bicycle. From Alchemy, which is a carbon frame, I don't see any reason not to use a carbon frame given that you are using the correct QR or axle mount. I use mine in a trainer all winter without any worry or effect, and that is from Matt Magzukzak, the Alchemy R&D director from Alchemy Bike. Kelfi, who repairs carbon frames of all brands. There may be some older trainers that attach the frame or dropouts in a manner that could damage the frame, but we've not seen any repair requests for such a thing, and it's another easy excuse to not honor a warranty. So that's from Craig Kelfi and Kelfi Design, and Kelfi does do a lot of repairs, but they are not seeing any problems from it, so that's good. And Ridley also has a comment here. Using a Ridley on a trainer does not affect the warranty and the frame. That is directly from the CEO of Ridley and at the Belgian Cycling Factory. So good to know. I would say probably not really much of a problem because it's a very controlled workout that you're doing when you're on your trainer. So it's not like you are, you know, out on the road and you're riding with a bunch of your overly aggressive friends, or you're racing your bike and you've got to jump hard out of the saddle and really torque on the bicycle, of which, you know, the bikes can handle that. That's what they're built for. I would be more concerned about riding outdoors and being in a situation where possibly you have a crash, which is going to do a lot more damage to a frame than riding on a trainer. But anyway, I thought it was a good thing to talk about on the Mechanical Minute. And I have one other thing that snuck in here while I was looking at it, and this came from the same page, and this is really interesting. Apparently, there are some problems with tire sealant that people are using on their tubeless tires and rims that there's no anodized surface. So where you could, this is wild. So if you take a look at a bike rim, sometimes the serial number will be etched into the anodized surface, leading to a hole that creates a leak so much that the rim doesn't hold air with a tubeless tire. So it's important that you only use ammonia-free sealants, slime tubeless sealant, or stands allegedly designed for tubeless tires. But this person suspects that is the sealant in direct contact with the aluminum at the etching site that's causing the corrosion and eventual failure. And then the question was, is this a common problem with tubeless rims, and should we be coating any etched areas with some kind of protectant before using these wheels? Would it be safe to place a piece of tape over the hole or use a tubeless rim strip to cover the hole to correct the problem? And Leonard comes back with, you've discovered a fundamental issue, namely that sealants will attack raw aluminum, and if there is no anodization to protect it. So Fulcrum and Campagnolo, same company, two-way fit rims are specifically designed for tubeless and require no rim tape as they have no spoke holes penetrating the rim bed. The factory etched through the anodization in order to put the serial number and that in place that the sealant is attached, since the raw aluminum was unprotected. Here are some answers to your questions from sealant makers. From Stands No Tubes, it's not the sealant. It's any liquid. All sealants have water in them, and his unprotected areas are allowing it to corrode. Not very good aluminum. That was in parentheses. He can spray paint or even use any tape that will seal the inside of the rim. Electrical tape will conform to most any shape. He could even use fingernail polish or anything that will create a coating. And that is directly from Stan, the founder of Stan's No Tubes. And there's another one from Effetto Mariposa. Exposed aluminum doesn't work well with the water contained in any sealant. Once again, back to the water. The best way to protect rims is adhesive tubeless tape. And these folks make one called Cafe Latex Tubeless Tape, one of the lightest in the market. And good tubeless tape is the best choice. While any adhesive tape will work in the short term, you really want a tape tested to stick to the rim with the constant action of liquid sealant. And that is from the founder of Effetto Mariposa, Alberto Di Giovannani. Nice. So here we go. That's it. It seems to be more of a water problem than it is any other kind of a solvent that is used within the sealants. So what you need to do is go down to your local bike shop and have a conversation with them about this, because this is a very interesting conversation, and certainly I think they will welcome the conversation. Just ask them what they know about it and see what they say. If you have a good bike shop and they know what they're doing, they've been doing a lot of tubeless tires over the years, they probably already know about this. And I would say this is probably a lot more of a word of caution to the do-it-yourselfer that is possibly purchasing products outside of the bicycle shop and doing things themselves and not paying attention to this sort of thing. So I would, if you're going to a local bike shop, you're probably okay. You're probably in pretty good hands, but I would check with them and certainly have the conversation, because it's an interesting conversation. I had never even thought about this. Or B, if you're doing it yourself, you need to take these precautions that Leonard Zinn has mentioned on the VeloNews site. So anyway, that brings me through to the end of my mechanical minute, or my maintenance minute. And so we talked a little bit about carbon bikes and also about tubeless wheels and tire sealants and corrosion. So moving on in, I've got a section in my content I'm calling milestones. And one of them is, it's sort of a sad one. Let me pop this. Here we go. So no more poo-poo. Do you know poo-poo?
Poo-poo platters?
No. If you're like a real cyclist from back in like the 60s and 70s, you would know who poo-poo is. If you
poo-poo
don't,
is a person?
Poo-poo is a person.
Oh,
yes.
No, I don't
yes.
know.
Poo-poo was his nickname, and he was Raymond Poulidor was his name. And Raymond Poulidor, I think he actually rode, he might have been the oldest cyclist to ever ride in the Tour de France. He might have gone that far. He used to ride a pink bicycle. It was really, really cool. So,
I approve.
And he happens to be Matthew van der Poel's grandfather. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Oh.
And Matthew van der Poel is like a great cyclocross racer and many-time world champion, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so his grandfather had been sick for some time. Poo-poo, the quote-unquote eternal second, passed away on Wednesday night at 2 o'clock in a hospital in his hometown of St. Leonard de Noblat.
I'm sorry.
So the eternal second is he raced when Eddie Merckx was racing, and so he was as good as he was always second. He just could not beat Merckx, and who could? I mean, Merckx basically ran the show back then. So he participated in the Tour de France 14 times and was on the final podium on 8 occasions, 3 times second. He won 7 stages but never managed to take the yellow jersey. In the eras of Jacques Anquetil and Eddie Merckx, his role as underdog and eternal second earned him extreme popularity in France. He also, his honor list also includes a victory in the Tour of Spain, Milan-San Remo, just a list of very, very famous races on down. His daughter, Corinne, married professional cyclist André van der Poel. His grandsons, David and Matthew van der Poel, are also professional racers. So it's quite a family of cyclists that came from Raymond Poulidor. And we always knew him as the guy who rode. He rode on a pink Mercier, I think is what it was.
Oh.
And it was that pink Mercier that actually inspired me to have Peter Weigel paint my bicycle pink when he made my bicycle.
Pink bikes are good.
And so he, you know, and a funny story about that is that Peter called me back 3 times and said, "Are you sure?" Because he just said, "It's really pink, Ron." I said, "I want it really pink. I want a pink bicycle." And he said, "Okay, but once I spray this thing, that's it. You're going to have to pay to have it redone if you don't like it." I said, "I'm going to like it. Paint it pink." And he painted it pink. And I had the only pink bike in the whole race circuit on the East Coast that I knew of. No one else had one. And 2 years later, lots of people had them. But so I'm a trendsetter. So there's a great picture on this website. This is pezcyclingnews.com. Of him with Peter Sagan, and it's just an awesome picture. So if you get a chance to go there, just check it out. Sorry to see you go, Raymond Poulidor. Cool guy, amazing cyclist, and obviously has put a big impact out there in the cycling world with the folks that have been in his family. So
you said
cool.
he rode a Mercier?
Yeah, I think he rode a Mercier.
Yeah.
It was pink.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rose pink, apparently.
Rose pink, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's my favorite color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what they say about pink? It's a weird thing. You might. I mean, this,
it's my favorite color.
You may, I know that, but you might want to fact check this one. But I heard that if pink was a color that would take power away from people.
Aww.
So if you were riding on the pink bike and everybody else had to look at it, you actually had an advantage.
Right.
Right. for what that's worth. But I don't know if that's true or not. That may have been, that may be, you know, urban legend or something.
My Pinarello is like the pink on it. I mean, my Pinarello, we got that in like 07 or something.
Yeah, it's very faded.
It's faded.
Yeah. Well, all right. So here's, I'll throw this out there. And if anybody out there has an Italian bicycle or has ever had an Italian bicycle, you might know about this. God, they're beautiful. They have the most gorgeous paint jobs when they start out, but their paint's terrible. They just
really?
Have horrible paint. Yeah. Aww. Yeah, when I was painting bicycles, back when I had the bike shop and I was painting bicycles over the wintertime, I was repainting a lot of Pinarellos and a lot of Colnagos. And a lot of Gios Torinos. Oh, God, I've repainted tons of those. Just a lot of repaints on Italian bikes because their paint, as gorgeous as it was when they first came out, they just it just didn't stay on the frame or it faded really fast or whatever.
Mine is faded.
So it wasn't like the horribly toxic American paint I was spraying in my basement. So we won't talk about that. hopefully that doesn't catch up with me later on. But anyway, and maybe it has already. Yeah, never know. So I'm going to put this out because it's that time of year where you're looking at your favorite cyclist and you're trying to figure out, what do I get my favorite cyclist for a holiday present? And there's a new book out, of course, you know, because there's always new books out, right?
Yeah, I know.
And this is, once again, this is from Pez Cycling News, P-E-Z Cycling News. And the bookshelf is The Greatest, The Life and Times of Beryl Burton. Now, I know that Fran has heard me talk about Beryl Burton before. But
Big
Beryl Burton. She was a hefty girl, but that girl could move a bicycle, and she was a longtime world champion in the time trial. And she was from England, and she where time trialing is a big, big deal in England, by the way. It's huge.
She had an OBE.
She had an OBE?
Yeah, an Order of the British Empire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, British author William Fotheringham is no stranger here, and his latest book, The Greatest, The Times and Life of Beryl Burton, is another fine example of cycling history taken in the context of society as it was then. Beryl Burton's own autobiography is a book that leaves out so much in comparison, focusing on her sporting achievements as if they were something that was the sum of her life, although perhaps that really was almost all that mattered to her. The accomplishments are dizzying. She won 96 national titles between 1957 and 1986, 15 medals at world championships between 1959 and 1973, including 7 world titles, complete dominance of women's time trialing in Britain for years, and speeds that rivaled all but the very best men's. And she actually beat the best male time trialist in Britain on September 17th, 1967, when she rode 277.25 miles in 12 hours, setting a new competition record. Wow! That's amazing. 277 miles in 12 hours?
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. So anyway, it's Beryl Burton. There's a new book out about Beryl Burton. She was an amazing, accomplished cyclist. Pretty cool. Infectious smile. Very cool. And she was tough as nails. God, she could move a bike. I remember looking at her bike, and there's actually at thepezcyclingnews.com, you'll see one of her bicycles that she's standing next to. Take a look at the outside chainring on that bike. It is enormous. She used to push huge gears, and she was definitely a grinder. I saw a few videos of her, and you saw the size gear she was riding on, and she was not spinning it as fast as some others were, but boy, she could move that thing. So Beryl Burton was found, unfortunately, on May 5th, 1996, dead next to her bicycle, having suffered a fatal heart attack while out delivering invitations to her upcoming 59th birthday.
Aww.
So sad, but true. Beryl is no longer with us, but she was truly the greatest cyclist of all times in women's cycling,
and
she has a lot to say about it.
She was 2 weeks and 2 days older than my dad.
Yeah. So anyway, Beryl Burton. Thought I'd mention it. Thought it would be kind of timely for this. So if you're looking for something unusual to take care of a cycling person in your life, then that might be a good thing to do. Moving on into the show, I have I'm going right to indoor training because it's that time of year.
Because I went right to indoor training.
Well, a lot of people are going there. We're having I think they're telling us that we're having an unusually cold November here.
Yes.
But, you know, that may change next week. You never know.
And I have some interesting news.
Yeah, what do you got?
That Zwift, last year I was trying to use Zwift, and Zwift didn't play well with Android. And there was all those workarounds that you had to do if you had Android, or you just, like, you know, sucked it up and got a Mac set up. Because it was written originally for Apple.
For Apple, right.
Well, there's a beta for Android.
Nice.
Yes. I just downloaded it onto my phone right now.
So that's fairly new then.
Yes. And I'll try
it. Good.
I'll try it before our next show and I'll report back.
Yeah. Do that. Yeah. Do that. I want to hear that the next show. Let's talk about that.
I'll download my Zwift.
See how that worked. And then you use another app too. What, Ruby?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Ruby plays very nicely with Android.
Yeah.
That's what I've been using
the
last few days.
And that's been good. And didn't they have some sort of an update too you were telling me about?
Well, Ruby, I don't know if it's an update. It seems like they've had updates, but when I got on Ruby, some of the routes that I had done last year said very kind people upload their GoPros and then you can ride their rides and you have a video. You can see the ride that you did. And so and then there are also AR rides. And then there are combined AR and GoPro. So I did a ride the other day. It was the ride in at Cook Creek. Or Cook Hill. It wasn't Cook Hill. I think it was Cook's Creek in Oregon. And so it was a point-to-point ride that I did. And you could see what was going on outside. And I had an avatar. And there were other people. And I could see them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was
That Zwift has been doing for a long
time. So it's a mixture of AR and GoPro. Because it was the actual course.
Right.
But they had AR superimposed on it. That was kind of cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. So I don't know if Zwift has that or if it's either or if it's only all AR. I'm not sure what the deal is with Zwift.
So if you
I can look.
If you have the technology and you have this all comes with a price tag. I will warn you ahead of time. If you have the technology and you have the trainer that can handle the technology, there's some pretty cool stuff you can do out there which make riding indoors a much more pleasant thing to do than it used to be years ago. Years ago, we would just turn up the stereo, or you know, maybe put a TV show on. My big thing was I would put on a half hour like sitcom type show, and I would do intervals during the commercials. And then once the show came back on, I'd kill it back down and go real easy. And you have no idea how many commercials there are in a 30-minute show. Until you do that. So it really opened my eyes as to how much advertising there actually is on TV. But, you know, so you can come up with any number of creative ways of training on your bike, but the new levels of technology are amazing. They really are amazing. You can even have a friend that lives, you know, three time zones away from you, and you can make an arrangement to go ride together at the same time.
So I've got the app open right now, and I'm watching. So you can just turn it on and watch people ride if you want to. So if you're into that thing where you watch people ride and stuff, you can watch people doing stuff on Zwift.
Wasn't there a South Park about that? Anyway.
Yes. yes. And so you're talking about different time zones. I mean, you can the person can be somewhere else in the world.
Right.
I mean, I've got all these flags here. So right now there's a guy from Germany and there's a guy from I don't know what country. This guy's from Italy, and there's another guy from Germany, and here this person's from the U.S. And what flag is that? I don't even know. But anyway, you can actually watch people riding, and I'm watching a particular person. I'm not sure where that flag is from. And you can see it's augmented reality. So I think that Zwift is all AR. I'm not certain that it's I'm not certain that there's, whereas you can upload GoPros like you can with Ruvi. That's a neat feature with Ruvi, because you're not necessarily having to do AR, because you know when you do Zwift basically has you ride in either London, Watopia, or Richmond, these virtual worlds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have them all mapped out, and I think you can do free rides around town. And then of course you can also race, and you can also do workouts.
Yep.
And so it's very interesting. It has all that going. What I'm not sure is if you can communicate with other riders, if there's some way to communicate and say hello.
You can with Zwift.
With Zwift. All right. Yeah, and so do you do that with headphones, or you do that by text?
That's a good question. That's a question we'd have to throw out to someone who does that all day long, and I will reach out to I'll reach out to Manchester Cycle, because I know Bob is on his Zwift all the time in the wintertime. So I know he talks about how I stopped by the store one day as he was getting ready to close, and I said, I'll let you go. And he goes, no, hang around. Don't worry about it. He just locked the door and locked me in and just started talking to me while he was getting on his trainer and doing his ride. But we were just having a nice conversation. But he said, oh, look, you know, so-and-so's on. And then I can't remember whether he went over. He had like a keyboard right next to his bike. He's got like a special little station he's made. And he was tapping him in or whatever, you know. And so it might have been by text. I'm not really sure. I'll bet that it's going to get sophisticated enough, so you're going to put a set of headphones on, you're going to have a mic, and you're going to be able to talk if they don't have that already, and they very may well have that. But
it's a sandbox game.
Excuse me?
Yes.
What does that mean?
A sandbox game means there's a world, and you can freely navigate in the world.
Okay.
So, like, you know, I think Minecraft and World of Warcraft.
Oh, World of Warcraft.
You can navigate yourself. Like, you don't have to follow a specific course. Like when you're playing Mario Brothers, if you're in the level, you're in a certain level.
Oh, you're dating yourself. Okay.
Whatever. Yeah.
Nobody
but people still play that. Yeah,
they
sure they do. Oh yeah.
Okay.
But you know, so you're in a certain level, and the game is what it is at that level. Whereas when you're it's a sandbox game means that you can navigate where you want. So if you're in London on Zwift, you can do your own ride and ride around, and you can see people. And I guess there's a way to do that.
How about that?
I don't know how you turn and stuff. I'm going to have to figure this out.
I don't know.
Hopefully by next week.
You'll figure it all out. I'm sure you'll figure it out. So I pulled this little piece right here. Why train on a bike with a bike trainer? 4 golden rules of indoor riding. Now, this does come from Saris, who makes Cyclops trainers. And so they're... this comes directly from their website. So if you want to see a little bit more about it or read about it yourself, you can do that. This is from Coach Matt Dixon, who discusses the value of riding on an indoor bike trainer versus riding outside. And Matt Dixon is the coach and founder of Purple Patch Fitness. So there's a few things that are stated here. How often I hear 60 minutes on a bike trainer is like 90 minutes on the road. As much as I appreciate the sentiment, I cannot think in those terms. An hour on the trainer is an hour on the trainer. It's a tool, a wonderful tool. And if used properly, if it's used properly. But if it's not, it is not riding on the road. And I will agree with that. Riding on the road is way different. There is there's a different level of resistance. The resistance changes without your ability to change it, because you'll be rolling up and over a hill or whatever. There's wind. There's all sorts of factors that happen when you're on the road. But if you are looking to keep your fitness level or maintain or maybe build on your fitness level and your strength level for the wintertime, I think that it's a good thing. So he states here what you cannot achieve on a trainer. And this is a big one. Number one on the list. Number one, handling skills. All basic yet important interactions with your bicycle are not replicated on when you're on a trainer. So if you want to become the national Zwift champion, good for you. But it's not how you, it's if you get yourself out in the real world, you may find a huge reality check. So just so you know, you can't develop a sense of balance, braking, cornering, descending, etc.
And these, rough terrain.
These are interactions that are so often lacking among triathletes. So we must realize that plenty of outside riding with focus on these fundamental skills will be beneficial to you. This man apparently trains a lot of triathletes. And then we add... We'll throw this in on the triathletes too. And then they ride that bike, that crazy bike that can't handle it anyway. But another story, that'll probably open up a can of worms somewhere.
What bike?
Terrain management. Using gears and pedal stroke to effectively manage rolling terrain, descents, and climbs cannot truly be developed on a trainer. With some of the software improvements, it's getting closer. But the true intuition and developing of the feeling is only achieved outside. And that's, you know, I mention that to people when they say, well, you know, you climb really well on your bike. You know, you seem to do really well on the hills. And I say, well, it's taken me many, many years to be able to read the hill. Like, you can look at the hill and you know what you're getting yourself into.
Yes.
But that takes years and years of development and trial and error. And how many times have you read the hill wrong, and you get three quarters of the way up the hill, and you go, uh-oh, I am completely out of gas. I blew this one big time.
Yeah.
It happens. But you do learn how to read the terrains best when you're outside, and you can't do that on the trainer.
No.
Standing out of the saddle, an important skill to develop to effectively manage terrain, short postural load, but also nail the counter-steering effect that is utilized in cornering, riding in the wind, and other interactions, yet impossible to develop when riding on a trainer that holds a bike in place laterally.
Right, because you can't do that side-to-side thingy that we do.
So those three things you really can't develop when you're on the trainer. But
I really have a hard time standing up when I'm on the trainer, when I get out of the saddle.
You should work on that, because you shouldn't have a hard time standing up on the saddle. We'll just work on it. We'll work on relaxing. I know. We'll work on relaxing your shoulders a little bit more or whatever. You should be able to be all right with that. What I'd really love to put you on, but that's
rollers.
A big, 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 big can of worms and problem, is put you on rollers.
Yeah.
If you want to increase... I will make a very bold statement here, and I'm open to discussion on this. If you want to increase your ability to handle your bicycle and ride a straight line, there is no better tool out there than rollers. Rollers are unbelievable. They you have very little room for error, because a normal roller is about 16 inches wide, so you've got 8 inches in either direction to keep yourself riding straight. If you're a rider who is, let's say you go out on group rides and you have people comment to you about the fact that you don't hold your line really well, then...
And sometimes they swear.
Don't spend a lot of money on a trainer. Spend money on a set of rollers and get yourself on a set of rollers and spend the winter riding on rollers. We had a young boy that showed up on one of our rides a few years ago, and he was just amazing. Small guy. He was absolutely beautiful on his bike. He's beautiful. And he was a motocross rider, and he picked up the bicycle for fitness, but he rode straight as an arrow. And he was the type of person you could roll up right next to him. You could bump up against him. He didn't move. He was perfect on his bike. And I said, where did you learn how to ride your bike like this? He goes, well, I'm a motocross rider. I said, well, okay, that explains a lot, because you know how to ride a vehicle that's on two wheels that gets itself in a lot of trouble a lot. But I said, no, I said, that's not it. How'd you learn how to ride your bike like this? And he said, oh, I ride the rollers in the wintertime. And that was it. He rides the rollers in the wintertime. You just, you know, you get to a point on rollers when you get really good at it, you can take your hands off the handlebars. I don't recommend this, by the way. This is not something that I'm trying to endorse, because you can fall off the bike on the rollers, and you can do what a good friend of ours did, and he actually dropped his shoulder hard into the sheetrock wall and put himself through the sheetrock wall. in his basement. I'm not going to mention any names, so I won't embarrass him on the air. But anyway, what you can get from a bicycle trainer, okay, which is very, very important, effective training in a controlled environment. Specific interval training becomes highly effective without the natural variability of the terrain outside. There is no coasting on a trainer, which is why many like to make the claim that 60 minutes of trainer riding is worth more than 60 minutes outside.
I can understand
that. It's a fair
that.
Argument. That's yes. a fair argument. You have a controlled environment to nail specific intervals without any coasting effect. I promise that you will never run out of a hill when doing low RPM hill reps on a trainer.
I'm looking at this Zwift, and I see why people get addicted to it. There's a lot to do in it.
We have friends that are very addicted to it. I got to get through a couple more things here really quickly, and I'm probably going to have to explore this again next week because we're not going to have enough time here. Pedal stroke and posture without the requirements to manage your bike around traffic, terrain, and other riders. The trainer provides the optimum environment to work on your pedal stroke and your retaining proper posture, including a mirror in your setup for self-guidance feedback, and you can begin the habit that from minute one until the end of your session, you do things well. So if you do have a chance to put your trainer in front of a mirror and look at your position, it will help you. This means form over force. Every interval can be achieved while retaining proper posture. How many times do I tell people, drop your elbows, drop your shoulders, relax, don't fight with the bike? And I do this where? In my indoor spin classes, indoor classes. I'm going to have to cover the rest of this afterwards because we are definitely running out of time. We've used a perfectly good hour up right now talking on Bicycle Talk.
That's good.
I will throw out the fact that upcoming events, go to bikereg.com. There are some cyclocross events coming up. There's a few recreational rides out there still, but it is getting cold. So chances are you're not going to find too much out there at this time, but that's the way it is, unless you find a good indoor program. So, my name is Pedal and Run, and you've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch.
Hi.
A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you've been listening to this live or on podcast and would like to comment, you can send me an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com, and you can also listen to more past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org or on iTunes. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, or better yet, be on the show as a guest, please send an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs.